And good afternoon. I'm Jonathan Bastian. This is WFPL's Here and Now. I'm now joined by Thomas Mann, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution and former Executive Director of the American Political Science Association, with Norman Ornstein. He's the co-author of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Thomas, welcome to the show.
Happy to be with you.
Well, this book, it really begins with the debt limit crisis of 2011, and I was laughing because it feels like Groundhog Day around here or something like that.
It's deja vu all over again.
Exactly. And just to start off, has anything changed from 2011 to 2013?
We're about to see. I think that the 2012 election, which after all was in the end a rejection of the Republican Party strategy of uniform and vehement opposition to anything and everything Obama proposed, that was a blow. They expected to be back in the White House, to have taken control of the Senate and enlarge their majority in the House. None of that happened. In fact, Republicans now are worrying a great deal about potential marginalization in presidential elections. Their constituencies are shrinking rather than growing. So there at least is a possibility of change, but the rhetoric surrounding the debt ceiling in recent days shows you that Republican leaders, at least today, are prepared to take the debt limit hostage, to engage in brinkmanship and possibly even detonate a weapon that would blow up the U.S. and global economy.
So if we think about the fiscal cliff negotiations, was there any positives in there to think that this stalemate we've been talking about, this politics of extremism that you write about, could be breaking a little bit? There could be some good signs?
Yes, there were. I mean, the two encouraging things is that Republicans have been hamstrung by their no new taxes pledge. It's kept them from playing any constructive role in policy making. And in the end, they went on record, not certainly by a majority of Republicans in the House, but basically, the Republican Party was part of an agreement to raise some marginal rates of very upper income families. That's a precedent that's important. The other thing is that Speaker Boehner, who has promised to follow the so-called Hastert rule of not bringing any legislative measure to the floor of the House for debate and votes if it doesn't already have a significant majority of Republican support in the House. Well, he did it because a majority of Republicans were unprepared to agree to any tax increase. And it passed. He also did the same thing yesterday with the aid to New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut following the devastating storm that we call Sandy. So, we're beginning to hear voices from the business community who were AWL, really missing in action when the debt ceiling was used in a destructive manner back in 2011. So there are at least signs that of some movement, some dissent among Republicans. Some are prepared to speak out on a range of matters, moving away from their nothing but opposition strategy. But it's going to be a difficult couple of months. We've got three deadlines coming up. The debt ceiling has to be raised. The sequestration of that is spending cuts across the board for defense and domestic programs scheduled to go into effect, and the continuing resolution that funds the government in the absence of appropriations bills being enacted into law,
right,
are all going to be coming up, and all of them are going to have to be resolved. A normal person looking on would say, hey, the challenge isn't that great. We've cut spending in 2011. We raised some taxes modestly at the end of the fiscal cliff. We need to do about another $1.5 trillion over 10 years. We could do it with a mix of spending cuts and revenue increases from tax expenditures and deductions, and it would stabilize our fiscal situation and allow the country and the government to turn to a whole host of pressing problems like jobs and economic growth and energy and immigration and
right,
and gun control. So hope springs eternal, but the pathologies of this extreme partisan polarization, and in particular of the Republican Party veering far off to become a
yep,
more radical party than a conservative one, are still with us.
Exactly. And that's what I want to get to here, is you write a lot about the roots of the politics of extremism here. You lay it out in a lot of different ways, ranging from the media to money in politics, filibusters. If you had to pinpoint this to one thing, to how we got to where we are in the last 50 years, what would you point to?
You know, it really is a shift in party coalitions that started in the early 60s. For most of the last century, there was a good deal of overlap between Democrats and Republicans. There were conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans. One could build coalitions with both parties having a hand in the lawmaking. But the Voting Rights Act, the Roe versus Wade abortion decision, the Proposition 13 in Texas, the anti-tax measure and the emergence of supply-side politics, neoconservative thinking on foreign policy, a range of social issues with the Christian conservatives embracing just one party, and as opposed to working with both in the past, it sort of turned the Democratic Party into a more homogeneous liberal party, and the conservative Republicans into a more like-minded conservative party. And over time, they came to take more differentiated positions. They came to engage in a permanent campaign, indeed war, to use the legislative process to gain power. Then you add in the outside forces, like changes in the new partisan media, beginning really with talk radio and Rush Limbaugh, and new groups forming up, hovering over primary elections and threatening incumbents, especially in the Republican Party, if they didn't keep to the party position. I think all of those then have contributed to the mess that we're in.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you believe that America as a whole, the electorate, has itself grown more polarized, or do you think it's the politicians and these outside factors that you're writing about?
You know, Americans have gone with this. This is no longer a story about a moderate, centrist, pragmatic public and polarized ideological elites. It turns out that that most Americans identify now as Democrats or Republicans, even those who say they are independents, actually lean to one of the parties and act accordingly. They've really come to view politics through the partisan lenses and kind of reinforce the extremism of their elected representatives. They speak out in districts that are overwhelmingly Republican or Democratic. It's like an echo chamber. And so you don't get the voice of the whole electorate heard because the individual members are representing constituents who think alike, and their thinking on most matters is really quite extreme. So it's both. It's the whole country, which is what makes it so much harder to change.
Well, part of this book deals with solutions to this whole issue we're talking about, and one of them is expanding the vote. You write a lot about Australia. Explain what they do there and how it potentially works.
Yeah, you know, we have now about 60% or just under of the eligible electorate turning out in presidential elections, 40% in a midterm congressional elections. In some primary elections, it can be down to 10% or 5%. The lower the turnout, the more likely you get people with strong views at one end or the other of the spectrum. In Australia, many decades ago, they had the same problem, but they instituted something they called mandatory attendance at the polls. Everyone is expected to show up at the polls. They can turn in a empty ballot. They don't have to vote for someone, but it's an expectation of citizenship. If they don't show up, they can be fined. The fine is about $15 or $20. They can write a letter explaining they were ill or they were out of town, and there'll be no fine. But it's built up an expectation that everyone will participate, so you don't have hundreds of millions of dollars spent trying to mobilize or demobilize voters. Everyone's going to show up, and that tends to turn the discussion and the debate more to the center, more to practical problems that engage a wider audience. It's very controversial in a country like ours. You know, our freedom says we don't have to vote and so on, but there's something to be said for the responsibility of citizenship, and I think if some of our elections had much higher turnouts, you would weaken the power of some of these well-funded groups or who hover over primaries and try to intimidate incumbents into sticking with the ideologically extreme position.
About 30 seconds here. Give us one more solution that could potentially help this polarization that you write about.
Listen, one thing I'd say is we have to do something to once again create a public square. The media has become so fractionalized. There's so much partisan media, people gravitating to sources of information with which they always agree and never hear anything else. The mainstream media has become more cowardly and sort of sees a balance everywhere. On the one hand, on the other, Republicans say this, but Democrats did that, and so they're no help to the public. We need, once again, possibly through the internet, to create a space where well-meaning people of different views can come together, get reliable information, and try to work towards some agreement.
That's Thomas Mann, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Thanks so much.
Delighted to be with you.
This is Here and Now.